take the blue pill. The story ends. You wake up in your bed and believe whatever you want to believe. You take the red pill. You stay in Wonderland. And I show you how deep the rabbit hole goes.
Blessed above all of creation, it was a rare and precious pearl. Conceived in faith and liberty, home of the brave, land of the free, it was the envy of the world. But this shining city on a hill has turned from the Creator's will and let evil take control. Now the reckless men who lead them want to strip away their freedom and to steal their very soul. Now it's smoke and mirrors, switch and bait, criticize, confiscate, and let the guilty walk away. In this once righteous, godly nation, in the halls of education, they forbid a child to pray. They say we need to spread the wealth. They pretend to guard the health of the feeble and the poor. While the hand they hold behind their back confuses and conceals the fact that the wolf is at the door. There's an unseen hand.
Well, good morning, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome again to Connecting the Dots with Dan Happel. Today we have a program that is going to be really quite fantastic. We have a gentleman online right now, Dr. Dennis Cuddy, who is a true scholar and expert in the New World Order and the political elite, and he really understands where all the bodies are buried. Dr. Cuddy has written over 20 books on the subject and has written numerous articles. He's taught at the university level. He's a PhD in history. And Dr. Cuddy is really going to explain to our listeners today just exactly how few people and how they control the world because they have the keys to the castle, as it were. And so with that, Dr. Cuddy, welcome to the show, and thank you for joining us this morning, and thank you for all you've done to try to expose this conspiracy hidden in plain sight.
Thank you for having me.
Well, I am always interested in people talking about how there are some of us that talk these crazy conspiracy theories. And the thing that I think you've found, and I've certainly found over the years, is that there's an awful lot more conspiracies than there are conspiracy theories. And the difference between a theory and a fact is that the facts seem to be playing themselves out right now in our public arena, and we have seen a change in our country that I think most people 20 or 30 years ago wouldn't have believed in a million years could happen to the United States. Yet here we are, and we're openly really supporting and touting communism and socialism in a big way. And our listeners need to understand this has been a plan that's been going on for a very long time. So, Dr. Cuddy, I want to start this program, first of all, giving you the floor, the microphone, to talk about how this whole process has been going on for a very long time and what the conspiracies really are.
Okay, well, to show how clever these people are and how imperceptible are their manipulations of the public, I'll start with just a general statement and then give a contemporary example. In 1928, a man named Edward Bernays, who had been in psychological warfare and his wife on the Allied American side in the First World War, He was hired by William Paley, who was a member of the Council on Foreign Relations, as Paley was just beginning CBS, Columbia Broadcasting System. And Paley hired him to be his chief advisor, but simultaneously, the same year, this individual, Bernays, had published a book called Propaganda. And he said many things, and I quote people like him in sort of a chronological fashion so the individual readers of my books or articles can see step by step how this proceeded. He says, and I'm paraphrasing here, he said, we now have the scientific means to manipulate you, the public, without you even knowing about it. And he was absolutely correct, and I'll give an example, well, maybe a couple of examples. Bernays in the 1930s was hired by Lucky Strike Cigarettes. And they had a pack out, a pack of cigarettes, a white pack with a red bull sign. What they wanted to do was introduce menthol, a white pack with a green bull sign. So they hired Bernays, and Bernays went to the garment district of New York and paid them to make red and green the fashion for the next year. Sure enough, Lucky Strike menthol went over very, very, very well because the public was conditioned by popular fashion. There was a psychological association going on. Well, later, the plan, you might say, okay, that's an isolated incident, isn't that interesting? But it's far more vast than that. Because it wasn't just an individual, and Bernays was known as the father of public opinion. It involved education, schooling, values. To show you how that happened, John Dewey, who was known as the father of progressive education, had been in Chicago, but he switched over to Columbia University. Dewey was not just a public education figure. He had belonged to the what is now called the League for Industrial Democracy, but formerly the Intercollegiate Socialist Society. So you'll see how socialism pervades all of this conspiracy. And Dewey then switched over to Columbia University and became dominant there. And by the early 1950s, they were graduating maybe half to two-thirds of the superintendents and principals of the 160 largest school systems in the whole country. So that by the early 1960s, they had control of the school systems down to the classroom level. Right to the classroom level. And what they were doing was not just, you know, we're here and we're controlling who's going to be made a principal or then the teachers and so forth and so on. What they were doing was changing the thinking of people like Bernays from the cognitive, that means the basics, reading, writing, math, to the affective domain, social relationships and feelings. Now you say, well, why would they do that? Well, there's a purpose behind it. Because if you think about things, you can figure them out. Most people do. So they wanted to get rid of that. They didn't want people to think so much as have an emotional reaction, That played out in society by the 1980s, where a lot of people from MTV went into commercial advertising. Prior to that, if you recall, if you're old enough, in the 1940s, 50s, 60s, so on, you would have a person appear on television and say, hello, here are the five reasons to buy Pepsi-Cola rather than Coca-Cola. They were appealing to your intelligence, your ability to think. But when the people from MTV went into commercial advertising beginning in the 80s, they put on the television ads which simply showed young people happy drinking Pepsi. And so the people of the time would say, oh, I want to be happy and young too, so I'll drink Pepsi. See, an emotional association. Now, why would they want to do that? Because it's very hard to control a public or a person who thinks, who actually thinks. It's much easier to control people who are emotionally guided, simply making an emotional reaction to something. What happens is, Orwell, in the late 1940s, had a book out called, it was called 1984. And in there, Big Brother was the controlling person. His agent was a fellow named O'Brien, and the hero was named Winston. And O'Brien would torture Winston. and Winston would say, "We will never succumb to Big Brother." And O'Brien said a couple of things. I mean, he said a lot of things, but a couple of things which I want to point out. He said, first of all, you're going to come to love Big Brother. You will love Big Brother. And secondly, he said, well, what if we quicken the tempo of human life? Now, you think of those two things and say, oh, yeah, okay, so what? So you'll come to love Big Brother. To show you how that specific thing from the 1940s is controlling today, I'll ask you a question. What do you think would happen if I went to a mall and had a bunch of people and said, I'd like to ask you a question. Suppose I were to take away your computer, your credit card, and your cell phone. The people say, no, don't do that. We love our computer, our credit card, and our cell phone. Well, those are Big Brother's mechanisms for knowing everything about you. They know what you buy in the store with your credit card. They know who you talk to with a cell phone because, I mean, how do you think the message goes up to a satellite and comes down again? Who runs the satellite? Who has access to the satellite? And the computer, they can tell, you know, what you like, what you don't like, what kind of news you're getting into and all that. So this, they have vast files already on every single one of us by use of the, by hacking into a whatever you want to call credit card, computer, cell phone. Controlling those three things gives them a portfolio about you. Nearly everything about you they already have because of that. And you will come to love that. See, you don't want to, no, don't take them away. Don't take them. We love it. We've come to love Big Brother. Now, the second thing, they quicken the tempo of human life, applies to what I was just saying about this emotional reaction. If they quicken the tempo of human life, here's what happens. In the 1950s, you used to see on television these old-fashioned shows, Andy Griffith and Ozzie and Harriet and Leave It to Beaver, nice family-oriented shows, right? Nice, slow pace. You would see people on the Today Show in the morning, a popular show with Dave Garraway, and he would be talking about like this. He would say, hello, people, the weather today is, or in the news today, Senator, so at that pace, see, just that pace. But now, if you go out and talk or listen to these millennials, there's a group of four or five, and they're talking simultaneously and very fast, very fast. That's part of the quickening tempo of human life. When you do that, when you quicken the tempo of human life, when you go, let's say, from an easy listening crooner types of music of the 30s and 40s, you know, very romantic, if you were the only girl, like that, and you go into the rock and roll and then rock in the 60s, it becomes fractious and quick, you know, and they keep saying, they start in the 60s, it's the beat, it's the beat, we love the beat. And so you quicken that tempo. And teenagers would go to these concerts and actually get high on the adrenaline rush that was being created. That's why they would go in massive numbers. You know, it was giving them a rush, sort of a high, you know, as if they were on some type of drug, a high. All right. Now, when you quicken that tempo of human life, you literally force people not to think. They don't have time to think. You would hear mothers starting in the 60s saying, oh, I'm so busy. I have to pick up Johnny at ball practice. I have to get Susie at ballet. I have to go to the grocery store. I have to get my hair done. Quick, 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 quick. You would rarely hear that earlier in the laid-back, easy-going, they used to call the Eisenhower era the sort of gentle era of the nation. So you quicken them like that. And when you quicken them like that, what happens is they are forced to make emotional reactions. They don't have time. They just don't have time to think. Now, to show you how far back this goes, it goes back at least to Alice in Wonderland. And you said, what? Alice in Wonderland? Lewis Carroll? The mid-1800s? If you carefully look at that book, these people are use symbolism. In that book, you had certain figures which represented certain aspects of a powerful group of people. Tweedledee and Tweedledum. They were supposed to be representing politicians who you couldn't tell anything different about them. They were both alike, like Republican or Democrat. They were just Tweedledee and Tweedledum. And then what you would have is the Red Queen and Alice. They're running, 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 running. And Alice all of a sudden says, phew, I'm tired. But it looks like we haven't gotten anywhere. They're just standing still. And the Red Queen says, Alice, you have to run twice as fast just to stay where you are. Now that, if you think about it, that has tremendous meaning to that one simple phrase. So what happens is when you quicken the tempo of human life going through the last part of the 1900s, the 20th century, you force people to not think but simply make emotional reactions. Now what does that make them? What that makes them is more like the primitive people, early people, more animalistic. That's what primitive people used to be like. They would have an immediate emotional reaction of fear, hunger, anger, like that, just like animals. That's the way animals react, fear, hunger, anger. The fox looking for the rabbit isn't sitting around thinking. Now, let's see, if next Tuesday I go over by that rock, there might be a rabbit. And he's not thinking about, you know, what granddad did. Now, let's see, what did granddaddy do? Did he teach me something about, you know? They don't think. They have simple emotional reaction. So in that way, the powerful people, I call them the power elite, make us more primitive and controllable and animalistic. And when you get a population like that, you can persuade them to do a whole lot of things. Now, what I'll skip to next is relative to that. 2 days ago, I had a letter to the editor in the Washington Post. And it was about this Alabama abortion decision. They passed a law in Alabama and similar ones in Georgia, in Missouri, and so forth, really attacking Roe versus Wade from 1973 in the Supreme Court. And I got into a lot of different aspects and the moral aspects and so forth. But I'm really going to talk not so much about the rightness or wrongness as what I was reacting to. I was reacting to an article by a Megan McArdle, who had appeared earlier in the Post, talking about this idea of settled law. Well, this is just settled law, and Roe versus Wade is settled law, so forget about it. You know, just leave it alone. You can't do anything. It's settled. It's over. Well, the people who are pronouncing those things, basically, they're either fooling themselves or they're a pack of liars. Because I'm telling you right now today, they would not consider the Dred Scott decision of the 1850s settled law. They would not consider Plessy versus Ferguson, which said separate but equal in the 1890s. And they would not say that Buck versus Bell in the 1920s was settled law. So they really don't believe in settled law themselves. It's just something for their own purposes. So where did this come from? Well, actually, it comes far, far back, but we'll just start around the time of the American Revolution. At the time of the American Revolution, you had a period just before that when we were debating whether to declare our independence or not. And so, as you know, July of 1776, we had the Declaration of Independence. But before that, just several months before that, you had the not coincidental founding of the Illuminati. The Illuminati. That was on May 1st of 1776. May 1st, not by accident. This is the May Day that the communists always celebrate, the Soviets and others celebrate. And I personally don't think it was an accident because these people are very bright and they know in advance what's going to happen. So they knew we were about to declare our independence. Now, what was the Illuminati? The Illuminati was founded by, I guess you'd call him a renegade Jesuit priest, Adam Weishaupt. And he is supposed to have just founded this group, and it did some, you know, dastardly things and so forth and so on. I don't think so. He had too quickly a vast array of really powerful and intelligent people in his group. And he didn't have airplanes or cell phones. I don't think this guy just happened to have this. I think they had been building this network for some time. This was very, very well planned, the Illuminati. Now, what did they do? They operated and were trying to gain basically control of the world at the time. And then in the about 1883, and if any of you want some further details about them, I have a 9-part series on the internet on the Illuminati. So you would just type in Dennis Cuddy and the Illuminati, and the 9-part series will tell you in detail all about them and what they were up to. But briefly, they were discovered by the Bavarian secret police, and they weren't captured and put in jail. They just dispersed. And you say, well, you know, that's the end of that. Weishaupt, his group was found out. That's the end. No, no, no. Weishaupt said, I have prepared for this. I have prepared for being found. and here's my plan. He dispersed them all through Europe and then over to the U.S. and Russia and so forth. What he did was the people going westward, went to Paris. They became known as the Parisian Outlaws League. They infiltrated Masonic lodges, and they fomented the French Revolution. I have a document from the early 1790s, and that's why when Dan was talking about conspiracy theory and so forth, I try not to deal in conspiracy theories. I actually have documents to prove what I'm saying. So I have an early 1790s document by the Marquis de Luché from France. It's in French. I can understand French. I took 7 years. I've forgotten a lot of it. But anyway, and in there, he is condemning this Illuminati who has infiltrated his beloved Masonic lodges. He said, these people are evil. They're going to try to take over the world. And basically, he was right. He was absolutely right. And what they would do is they would foment the French Revolution. Now, the French Revolution's watchwords are liberté, égalité, fraternité. Sounds like ours, you know, liberty, equality, and brotherhood, like that. But it was far, far different from our values. Our values in Declaration of Independence were based on the Bible, biblical values. The father of the Constitution was James Madison. And he literally tried to implant in there a lot of the teachings of Reverend Witherspoon, who was his teacher, Reverend Witherspoon. Very, very biblical values inserted into our constitutional system. On the other hand, the French, by liberté, they meant license. They didn't mean liberty like we know it, freedom like we have under the Bible. You know, we have freedom according to biblical values. He meant license. And to show you exactly how far that went, they actually put a prostitute on the altar of the Cathedral of Notre Dame in Paris, symbolizing that they weren't just overthrowing the Bourbons, you know, the Louis, the 14th, 15th, those, that dynasty. They were overthrowing God. No God was going to tell them what to do. The slogan was, do what thou wilt. Do whatever you want. And to show you how that applies to abortion, for example, that I started with, one of the people involved there was the Marquis de Sade. The Marquis de Sade, from which the word sadist comes, a sadist. And he wrote a book called Philosophie dans le boudoir, the philosophy in the bedroom. And he said, go and have an abortion. Do whatever you want. You know, lie, rape, kill, steal, babies, whoever. Do whatever you want. And so the French Revolution was very, very bloody. Very bloody. And the second phase was even more bloody than the first. There were certain people involved in the first part of the French Revolution thinking, well, you know, we're going over through these nasty kings and all who you know, have this attitude. You may have heard the phrase from Marie Antoinette, let them eat cake. Actually, she didn't really say that. But the attitude of royalty was, well, we're up here and the peasants are just, you know, tough luck. They're down there. So what happened was they fomented the French Revolution, and people like the Marquis de Lafayette and people like Citizen Genet, they were always called citizens, you know, once the revolution started, citizen this and citizen that, because they're supposed to be equal, you know. Like I said, égalité, equality, they're supposed to be equal, although they really weren't equal. So what happened was the Marquis de Lafayette and Citizen Genet were two people I want to use as an example. Citizen Genet was connected with the Illuminati, and he was first sent to Russia. Well, the Russians aren't stupid. They found out what he was up to, you know, having all these revolutions all over the place. And so they kicked him out. So where did he come first? He came after that into the port of Charleston, worked his way up through the Carolinas into Pennsylvania, and fomented the Whiskey Rebellion. You may remember that from your high school days, the Whiskey Rebellion in Pennsylvania, Citizen Genet, and so on. And he called what he was doing the result of his democratic societies. See, the U.S. liked democratic things, democratic societies. However, as an example of how I get documents to prove what I'm saying, I asked the Librarian of Congress, his name at the time I asked was James Billington, and I said, Dr. Billington, would you do something for me? He said, okay, what? I said, you have a rare document there, just one of a kind, and it's under a glass cover. It's so rare. I said, would you please get that out and make a copy of it for me? And he did. He was very, very kind about that. And so what I did was, you look at that document. And in there, the title of the thing by John Wood in 1802 is The Clintonian Faction, Clinton meaning DeWitt Clinton was the governor of New York, The Clintonian Faction of the Columbian Illuminati. And so in there, Wood had placed the oath of these democratic societies, like the one with Citizen Genet that fomented the Whiskey Rebellion, and I laid it down right next to the original Bavarian Illuminati oath, and they were identical. So that proves that Genet was connected with the Illuminati and trying to foment these revolutions, but did not want to be known as Illuminati, but simply a nice democratic society. Well, you had a difference of opinion between Thomas Jefferson and George Washington. Jefferson had followed Benjamin Franklin as our emissary to France. Jefferson was sort of fond, and he got in the swing of things with the early part of the French Revolution, thinking it was similar to ours. It turned out not to be. So he actually had defended Adam Weishaupt. He said, oh, he's a good guy, he's just a philanthropist, no problem. But Washington knew differently. And I have a 1798 letter from George Washington to a Reverend Snyder. Reverend Snyder has asked him, he said, Mr. President, did you know the Illuminati's here? And Washington's response is, absolutely, I know they're here, and I'm very, very concerned about it. So when Thomas Jefferson came back, he became George Washington's Secretary of State. And Washington was, like, you know, just fed up with these people and these democratic society revolutions. We actually almost lost our country. Most people don't know that. Even before Washington, D.C. was built. You remember our capitals before Washington had been New York and Philadelphia. Well, when Jefferson comes back, John Adams writes him and says, listen, Thomas, you don't know this, but we almost lost the country before it actually even began, practically, because there was one of these democratic societies. 10,000 members, 10,000 people had surrounded the president's residence in Philadelphia, going to overthrow the government, even before it, you know, really got started well, even before Washington, D.C. was built. He said, Thomas, you know, these people are bad. You better stop defending all of this, you know, the French Revolution types. And so what happened was Washington sent word to his Secretary of State, Jefferson. He said, Thomas, get this guy out of here. You're the Secretary of State. You tell him he's got to leave this country. We're not going to put up with any of these shenanigans again. And so Thomas reluctantly wrote a letter to his friend, Citizen Genet, saying, you'll have to leave. The president says you got to leave. So what do you think happened? Did he leave? Nope. He wrote a letter back to Jefferson. He said, Thomas, you're the one who initiated me into these mysteries. You're the one who did this. So you have to understand there's more than meets the eye to some of these people in our past. So anyway, I'll cut this sort of short because I want to go into the communist aspect of it. Citizen Genet was clever. He said, please don't send me back to France because this is the second phase and they're going to guillotine me and everything else. So cleverly, he went up to New York and married DeWitt Clinton's daughter. So he was allowed to stay because he had married into the leading family of New York. All right, so what happens with the French Revolution? Well, the Illuminati spreads all over the place secretly. One of the Illuminist names was Pestalozzi. He was a Swiss Illuminist. And his works started being used in the U.S. in education in 1806, that far back. And so what happened is the father of American public education was Horace Mann in Massachusetts. And so Horace Mann, by the 1820s, had become a devotee of this guy Pestalozzi, an Illuminati member whose code name was Alfred. They all had these code names, code name this and that and so forth. The leader, Weishaupt, was code name was Spartacus. So anyway, so in education, Horace Mann, the father of American public education, became a devotee of his. And later on, I'm skipping far, far forward, into the 1870s, the first laboratory school in the world was by a Wilhelm Wundt, W-U-N-D-T, in Leipzig in 1879. Well, Wundt's grandfather had been a member of the original Illuminati, codename Raphael. Now, why am I telling you about this Wundt guy? because his first American PhD, coming out of Leipzig in 1879, actually he was 2 or 3 years later, in 1882, was a G. Stanley Hall. Well, who's he? G. Stanley Hall, when he got his PhD, came back to Johns Hopkins, and guess who he mentored? John Dewey. So you have this flow of events and people going right back to the Illuminati. Well, what's all this got to do with communism? Well, what happened was the Parisian Outlaws League morphed into something called the League of the Just. Now, the League of the Just are the people who funded Karl Marx to write his Communist Manifesto with Friedrich Engels in 1848, and right after that you had a revolution, you know, all over the place in Europe, all over the place. And people say, okay, well, he's the founder of communism. No, he's not. Remember I mentioned the Marquis de Lafayette? The Marquis de Lafayette didn't really want to go back to France anytime soon because it was the second phase. So he brought over here a woman named Madame Françoise Darousemont. She was a real, I guess you would call her, communist girl. And she was free-loving everything, so she said, well, call me Fanny, Fanny Wright. And she and the Owenites, who had been union-type people from Britain, came over and founded the first commune way before Karl Marx. Karl Marx had to have all this stuff explained to him by Ludwig von Westphalen, his grandfather. Karl Marx was a Johnny-come-lately. So the first commune was founded by Fanny Wright and the Owenites, Robert Owen and Robert Dale Owen, in New Harmony, Indiana, in 1825. And you're saying, why? I mean, why Indiana? Why would you go to Indiana? Well, they wanted a place that was sparsely populated, but a state, so that they could get a person elected to Congress. To Congress. They wanted somebody in Congress. And so they did. They did. They got Robert Dale Owen, one of the original founders there, to be elected to Congress. Now, why would they want to do that? Because what they were doing was part of a master plan, a master plan. They started in New Harmony, Indiana, but 3 years later, in 1828, they formed the Working Men's Party in New York. So you have this Indiana and New York connection. Sounds strange, but it's not. Indiana was a sparsely populated area where they could do their thing and get somebody elected Congress. But New York was the center of labor activity. So they founded the Working Men's Party, which was 20-some years before Marx even said, workers of the world unite. Workers of the world unite. The first thing was this Working Men's Party. Now, how do we know what they were up to? Well, they joined up with a big money man up there in the Northeast called Orestes Brownson. So there are three of them, the Owenites, Fanny Wright, and Orestes Brownson. Well, Brownson eventually woke up, and he said, oh, my goodness, what have I done? So he wrote a 20-volume set about his life. And in volume 19, I have a quote from there where he says, I'm going to tell you what we were up to because I'm tired of this nonsense. I'm a Christian now. I'm converting, and, you know, I'm not going to do this communist stuff anymore. And so here's what we were up to. He said we were going to do two things, control education and control labor in the country. In education, he said the reason we were going to do that is we were going to get God out of schools, out of education. Before that time, you had the McGuffey readers, which were very, very religiously based. You know, in Adam's Fall, we have sinneth all. That's how you learned your ABCs. He said we got to get rid of that. We're communists. We're going to get rid of it. And remember, this is before Karl Marx. We're going to get rid of that. So we're going to take over the schools. We're going to call them national schools. They'll be public schools. We're going to get God out of them. But we got to replace it with something. What are we going to replace it with? We can't just say dump God. So what they did was they were going to replace God with science. Science was going to be the new God. Now, how do we know that? Because that's what Robert Dale Owen was doing in Congress. He was founding the Smithsonian. That was going to be their new temple of science, the Smithsonian. Yeah. But it was part of a long process. Once he got finished doing that, he became our emissary, I believe it was to Genoa. Rome is not the banking capital of Italy at the time. I believe it was Genoa. So anyway, he went there as the emissary, and they were fomenting revolutions, and money was the key, and so forth and so on. And I'm not going to go through, you know, too much of this, but the the fact is, there are all these interactions. Coming out of the French Revolution, one of the main revolutionists was a Saint-Simon, and he had a young fellow who was a secretary called Auguste Comte, C-O-M-T-E. Well, Comte, in the early 1800s, started to develop this, what he called a religion of humanity. Now, forget God. Get God out of this. We have a new religion of humanity based on what man wants to do, you know, sort of like Eve and Adam. You know, I'm going to do whatever I want to, despite what God says. And he called it a positivistic religion. He said that this is positive. It's a religion for man. We're going to have our own thing here. And we're going to, you know, forget about God. And it hooked up then with the evolutionists, you know, Herbert Spencer and then Darwin and so forth and so on, which were actually a bunch of racists. If you look at Darwin really wrote The Origin of the Species, 1859, and then Descent of Man in 1871. And the end of one of those titles is, and favored races. He referred to the Aborigine people of Australia as apes. So these elitists were a bunch of racists coming up, to Margaret Sanger, the founder of Planned Parenthood. And most people say, oh, wonderful Margaret Sanger. She was a racist. She said there were dysgenic stocks. Jews were dysgenic. Southern European Catholics are inferior, and blacks are inferior. She had what's called the Negro Project, and so forth. So here they are. They proclaim themselves as enlightened liberals. We are wonderful. We care for people. But really, they were a bunch of eugenicists and favoring euthanasia. And the decision I mentioned, Buck versus Bell, was into forcible sterilization. Forcible. And Woodrow Wilson, who was our president during the First World War, had one of the most radical forced sterilization laws you have ever seen. But here he is, you know, admired by the left and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
So,
Dr. Cuddy, I hate to interrupt, but we're going to stop for a short commercial break, and we'll pick it up on the other side of that break.
Okay.
All righty, we're back from the break. I'm sorry that I have to stop you, but we had a commercial break that we had to get into. Dr. Cuddy, please continue with your thoughts.
Okay, so what happens is there's a dialectical process. You might have heard of the Marxian dialectic, Karl Marx, or the Hegelian dialectic. So the powerful people saw us becoming independent with the Declaration of Independence. All right, that was the thesis. In the dialectic, you create the opposite. So they created the antithesis, which would be communism, Karl Marx, and then they would have what was called the synthesis. And the synthesis, ultimately, and we're approaching it, would be a world socialist government. And that's why I have in my books a cartoon from 1911, and it's from the St. Louis Post-Dispatch by Robert Miner. And in there is a picture of Karl Marx, and he's standing on Wall Street. And the people around him are Teddy Roosevelt, J.P. Morgan, John D. Rockefeller, and they're saying, delighted. They're shaking his hand. So you say, oh, they're shaking the hand of communism. No, under Marx's arm is a book. It's not his manifesto. It says socialism. Socialism. You say, well, why? Because monopoly capitalists are different from the rest of us, you know, free enterprise capitalists, average people. Monopoly capitalists actually like socialism because they can control the politicians. You know, they buy politicians. That's what they do. And then those politicians would enact rules and regulations and laws which would benefit them, the monopoly capitalists, keep competition down. So John D. Rockefeller actually once said competition is a sin. It's a sin. They thought they control everything. We are the best and the brightest and all this sort of stuff. So what you have is people forming, let's say, the Soviet Union. But you have to remember, USSR is the Union of Soviet Socialist Republics. But we'll call them communism. You say, well, this is horrible. You know, how did this happen? We did it. The powerful people, I mean, the power elite did it. One of the members of the Federal Reserve was James Thompson. He actually put up $1 million of his own money. This is when $1 million was, you know, worth 20 or 30 today, for the Russian Revolution, for the revolution. Now, who was their supporter? Who was their agent? Who was going to do what was happening? Presidents like Woodrow Wilson don't do anything. They have handlers. The power elite had a handler for him named Colonel Edward Mandel House. Edward Mandel House, in 1911, the year before Wilson was elected, wrote anonymously a book called Philip Drew Administrator. And he said in there, what we're going to have, what we're going to do, is socialism is dreamed of by Karl Marx. That's what we're planning. That's our plan. Karl Marx is socialism. That's what we're going to have. And so later in the first administration of Wilson, you had Mr. Lane, I think he was Secretary of the Interior, said everything in that book is coming to pass under Woodrow Wilson, the Wilson administration. Bernard Baruch was a big money guy at the time. He had led Woodrow Wilson up the steps like a puppy dog. This is a quote, like a puppy dog, to meet his handlers. And after they met his handlers, and they told him, this is what you're going to do, Woodrow, when you get in there, you know. They laughed as he left, and they said, let's see how our other candidate's doing, by whom they meant Teddy Roosevelt. They wanted to get Teddy Roosevelt in there to split the vote with President Taft so Wilson would be elected president. Now, to show you how one person can control the entire century, I have a page from the diary of Colonel House. I don't think it's ever been published. And in that diary, he says, you know, they've had the Russian Revolution. We like this. We like the revolution. We want it. It's part of our plan. And he says, but Wilson, my boss, and Clemenceau of France and Orlando of Italy, they're becoming concerned about these communists and their revolutionary ways. He said, they think they want to put him down. He said, House, I told him, no, can't do it. Can't do it. Too far along. And his next paragraph, he says, but I knew we really could have. Just a battalion could have put him down. Now, if that guy hadn't lied, think about it. There would have been no Stalin, no Communist Chinese Revolution, no Korean War, no Vietnam War, no Vladimir Putin, none of this of the century. This guy, House, is largely responsible for the carnage of the entire 20th century. And he was the agent of these power elite people. And so we did have a communist Chinese revolution. Why? Well, because in 1931, Dmitry Manuelsky was a communist theoretician, and he's addressing the Comintern. And he says, in 50 years or so, we're going to have the most impressive peace offensive the world has ever seen. And he said, the West, stupid and decadent, will fall for it. So who shows up 50 years later, right, almost right on the dot? Gorbachev. Gorbachev previously had been called, you know, the evil empire, an evil empire. But remember, in the 1980s, he became our buddy. Oh, the people would greet him at the dots, Gorby, like that. I was in the U.S. Department of Education at the time, and I was infuriated. Because they actually, Secretary of State Shultz actually invited these people over here for what was called the Soviet-American Exchange Agreement. We had communists in this country actually helping us write our curriculum for our students in our schools. That happened under Reagan. The scenario was it's from long, long ago. They say, well, how did this happen? I mean, how do these people do this? They do this by getting key people in place. When I was in Washington, we had a term, a phrase that was... personnel is policy. So who was around at these times? People like Henry Kissinger were around. Zbigniew Brzezinski were around. Zbigniew Brzezinski was the advisor largely for Democrats like Jimmy Carter and Obama and so forth. Kissinger was for Republicans like Richard Nixon and so forth. So what do these people do? Well, Brzezinski is very instrumental in Barack Obama's plan. Barack Obama didn't happen. Barack Obama was planned. Bill Clinton was planned. Bill Clinton is a Rhodes Scholar. That is part of Cecil Rhodes' plan from the late 1800s. I have the original membership of his secret Society of the Elect, as he said, quote, to take the government of the whole world. I have the original membership list from that time. But let's stick to the communist sort of aspect of it. Zbigniew Brzezinski was a young professor, and he wrote a book called Between Two Ages. And in there, in 1970, he's praising Marxism. I praise Marxism. David Rockefeller liked that. He picked up Brzezinski as the first director of his Trilateralist Commission, and then he made him the National Security Advisor for Jimmy Carter. That's how Jimmy Carter was controlled, by somebody who loved Marxism. So what happened in 1980? President Reagan defeats him, and what does Brzezinski do? He goes to Columbia University. What do you say? What's that got to do with Barack Obama? Barack Obama, as a young person, his mother was in Kansas. There was a man, his last name was Johnson, I think the word Frank Johnson. He was a communist in Kansas. The family, Ann Dunham, Barack Obama's mother, moved from there to Seattle. Johnson moves to Seattle. He's a self-professed communist. And later he writes in his book about having sex with a woman named Ann. Then the Dunham family moves to Hawaii. Johnson moves to Hawaii. Remember, the man's a communist. Supposedly, Barack Obama, the senior, gets married, has a child, and then he disappeared. But Johnson's still there. And when Barack Obama, the president, writes his book, he refers to this guy, Johnson, as Papa, 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 like that. So this communist, this self-avowed communist, is training up this little Barack Obama who would become president. And so what happens is they send him to Occidental College in California. Now, that's one of those interesting colleges, because when I was in the Reagan administration, my boss was the chairman of a council who was also the president of Occidental College. He once came up to me and said, "Dennis, let me know if there's something you want me to do for you." So Barack Obama stayed there for only a short time. They were watching him, seeing, you know, what is he up to, what's he like, and so forth and so on. What's he like? And then they sent him to Columbia. Why Columbia? That's where Brzezinski is, you know, the one who loves Marxism. And what happens? They took a survey when Barack Obama became a person running for president, and they interviewed the 400-some members of his graduating major. None of them could remember him even attending class. None of them. However, they did remember he spent a lot of time with Brzezinski. That's because that's where he was receiving his marching orders for when he became president, when he became president. And so what they do is they get people, they watch them very, very, very young. And they, you know, watch them as they come up. They watch Bill Clinton. Bill Clinton is a Southern Baptist. But he went to Georgetown, a Jesuit institution, a Catholic Jesuit. Why? You know why? Two people did that. Professor Carol Quigley loved these powerful people, the power elite. He wrote a book called Tragedy and Hope. His tragedy, he says, was that the American people ran the country. He said, "This is bad. This is bad." The hope is that these powerful people behind the scenes should run the country, as they do. They let him look at their secret records, that's what they called them, in the early 1960s. He loved them. So he's the professor. So what happened? John Foster Dulles, our Secretary of State under Eisenhower, he had a son named Avery Dulles. He became a Catholic and rose very quickly to the position of cardinal, and he was at Georgetown. Those two saw to it that Bill Clinton got a Rhodes Scholarship. But if you remember Bill Clinton, he was a womanizer, pothead, and all that stuff. So when he took a side trip, like Brzezinski had Obama take a side trip to Pakistan, when he took a side trip to Moscow, now this, remember, this is in the late 60s, early 70s when it's the evil empire. They had to keep an eye on him. So guess who was over there? A priest named Father McSorley from Georgetown, keeping an eye on this guy, because he was, you know, who knows what he was doing with Russian women and, you know, whatever. So they have to, they pick these young people, they watch them through the years very carefully to be sure that they're in line, like whether it's Clinton, whether it's Obama, whatever. And to show you what the outcome is, like a world government, Strobe Talbott was the roommate, the Rhodes Scholar roommate of Bill Clinton at Oxford. In 1992, when Clinton's running for president, Strobe Talbott, who became number two at the State Department, wrote an article in Time magazine in which he said perhaps national sovereignty is not such a great idea after all, and the case for world government is clinched. I have a letter, and I put it in some of my books, signed by Bill Clinton. Most people don't have any idea about this letter, and it's signed by Bill Clinton. Strobe Talbott got an award for that from the World Federalist Association, whose sole purpose is for a world federal government. And you know, in a federal government, you don't tell Washington what to do. Washington tells us what to do. So in a world government, we're not going to tell the world government what to do. They're going to tell us what to do. And in that letter, he says, Clinton says, "That's a great thing you've given Strobe. He's very deserving of it. One of your previous presidents, Norman Cousins, worked for world government." And Clinton closes the letters by saying, "Best wishes for future success." Best wishes for future citizens. No president should be saying, "I want a world federal government," because that undermines totally our national sovereignty. But I have a letter where Clinton is actually doing that. He's actually doing that. So this plan goes far, far back. These powerful people control things. And I guarantee you, if I went out and asked the public, and I said something like this, I said, suppose I told you David Rockefeller was part of a secret cabal, internationalists who are conspiring against the best interest of the United States in order to form a more integrated global political and economic structure, one world, if you will. The people say, it's ridiculous. That's conspiracy theory nonsense. That's garbage.
And it's also a quote out of his own book. Yeah.
He actually said that in his own book, Memoirs, in 2002. At the end of what I just told you, he said, if that's the charge, I stand guilty and I'm proud of it. Have you ever seen ABC News, NBC, CBS, Washington Post, or New York Times reveal that? David Brooks wrote a long book review about that book for the New York Times, and nowhere in there did he mention it. Nowhere. Ask yourself, why not? Because part of this plan was to take over the press, and they did. Rockefeller and these guys were getting a lot of flack, and so they said, let's take over the press. So they said, well, we'll have to buy 300 newspapers. J.P. Morgan said, no, we ain't got to do that. We'll buy up the top 25 because the others just feed off of them, And so that's how they would control the press. And well, how do they control the press? Well, if you control it through your purchase, like they would be sneaky. They would go like through New Haven Railroad or something, which owned the Northeastern rail manufacturers and so on and so on. There would not be a direct line to them. It's sort of like Teddy Roosevelt. In your history books, Teddy Roosevelt said, he's a great trust buster. He's wonderful. No, he wasn't. All he did was disperse Standard Oil. So now he had Standard Oil of Ohio, of California, whatever. It became a multi-headed hydra and had interlocking directorates. The same people who had been on Standard Oil, you know, the Standard Oil that he was busting, they simply dispersed. They became the Standard Oil Board of California, of Pennsylvania, of Ohio, and so forth. So actually he made it more difficult to control. So, you know, there's this image that we have of people which is, you know, totally ridiculous. What happened everybody praises Franklin Roosevelt. He praises Franklin Roosevelt. Roosevelt was saying, some of my best friends are communists. Some of my best friends. Harry Hopkins was in charge of the Lend-Lease program. He actually gave information on nuclear activities to the Russians, the Soviet Union, as part of our peace initiative. And we actually called Stalin Uncle Joe, Uncle Joe the communist. Same thing with the Chinese. General Marshall, you know, great general, he was a member of the IPS, IPS Pacific Society. He was a far leftist. He deliberately, and I have a document where he deliberately disarmed the nationalist Chinese so the communist Chinese could win in 1949. They wanted that to happen. They wanted it to happen. Why? Well, if you're going to have the greatest peace offensive the world has ever seen in 1980s with Gorbachev, you have to have an enemy to replace him. Okay? So they created the Communist Chinese Revolution. I have a picture of the eight people at the origin, the young Mao Zedong, of the Communist Chinese Revolution. Seven of them are young Chinese. One is an old guy with white hair, and he's British. He was the money guy. He's the money guy. He flows out of that Cecil Rhodes, you know, that would manage, because by money they control nations and individuals all around the world. And what they would say is, get them in debt. Look at our debt. What is our debt now? It's like 20-some trillion. It used to be very little, but 20 trillion. That's how you control the people. That's how you control them. Whether it's England, us, China, whoever it is. All of these people. And that's why most of our presidents are puppets. They're puppets. I have a letter signed by Franklin Roosevelt, and he's just had a talk with Jack Morgan, J.P. Morgan Jr., and he's writing to that guy, Colonel House, I mentioned. He said, listen, House, as you and I know, a financial element in our larger centers has owned, not just influenced, owned our government ever since the days of Andrew Jackson.
Mm-hmm.
And so this goes on and on and on. I think our time's running out, isn't it?
We're getting close, Dr. Cuddy, and I want to, this is a fascinating discussion. I hope we can get you back on, because I know that you've got some family obligations you've got to leave for, but
I'd like
love to get you back on.
I'd like to, if at the end, if we have time, to just mention my mother's situation.
Yes, yes, please do. And thank you for being our guest in advance. I want to say that. Thank you for being our guest. It's been a fascinating hour. And frankly, like I told you earlier, with your information, this could go on for a day and we'd just scratch the surface. So please go ahead and first of all, tell our listeners a little bit about some of the different writings and books that you've done so that we can plug those. And then if you would like to speak a little bit about your mother and her situation.
Okay, thank you very much. I've had over 20 books, as Dan said, published. They sell out very quickly, but you can still get them very cheaply, used copies on Amazon. I started with one, about 1991, called Now is the Dawning of the New Age, New World Order, because that was a phrase that was becoming very popular at the time, and I was showing the New Age aspect and what it was doing and the New World Order and how that was linking. You're not going to have just a one world religion, one world economy, a one world government, but there is a plan for one world religion as well. The term for that is syncretism. So this is a vast plan, and I show how the Baptist, for example, the last thing you think of is Baptist and socialism and all, but the first book I found, it was titled New World Orders by Samuel Zane Batten in 1919, published by the American Baptist Society. Of all places, saying we need a world socialist government. So this is Methodist, Catholic, Buddhist, whatever. This thing involves everybody. Then I was able to obtain, like I said, the Secret Society membership list, so I wrote a book called Secret Records Revealed. There was so much involved that I had to do a sequel, an even larger book called The Globalists. Then I started looking at specific things that were happening as examples. So I would look at 9/11. I think I had the first book published on 9/11 called September 11 Prior Knowledge. And there's a lot of stuff. I have an article I hope is coming out at the anniversary showing what you have not been told. What you have not been told about that. And then there was so much to that that I had to come out with another one called Cover Up, and I go into even more depth about that. Then we come to the period of what was happening in general in the nation, how they were controlling us mentally, education, socially. So I did a three-part book series on that, National Mental Health Program. Then there was another one called Mental Illness, and then the third volume, Mental Health, Education, and Social Control. I would give very, very important quotes in there and revelations, documents. Like people would say, oh, come on, they're not controlling us. Oh, yeah. John Rawlings Reese was a big name vice president with something called Tavistock, one of these big think tanks in England. And he wrote a book in Mental Health, that's the name of the journal, 1940, in which he said, we have made a useful attack on two main professions, education and the church. Education and church. Well, what's he mean? Well, I'll give an example. Shortly thereafter, you had Alger Hiss, the communist spy, in our government, very, very prominent, and he was responsible for selecting the first head of the World Health Organization, Brock Chisholm, a Canadian psychiatrist. And so I got, in 1946, the journal Psychiatry, the February issue, and in there, Brock Chisholm, as the new head of the WHO, was writing different things, and he says, you know what the real problem is? The real problem is this concept of right and wrong that parents and preachers are teaching our children. We're going to get rid of that. Now, this is the head of the World Health Organization. And then Sir Julian Huxley he was a Fabian socialist, became first head of UNESCO. UNESCO, a really nasty group, which had a Toward World Understanding series of about 10 volumes around 1950 or so, where it said parents are teaching their children to breathe the poisoned air of nationalism. We can't have that. We have to have little globalist citizens. And if you think, well, that's way back, who cares? No, I have a document from Seattle's public schools, the Seattle Memorandum. It's the Rockefeller Project. And this private memo says, hey, look, this globalism term is, the right wing's catching on to this. We got to change it to multiculturalism. See, so what I do is not just say this is happening. I actually try and show these documents. And so then I wrote a book called The New World Order and the Rise of Techno-Feudalism that covered largely the Obama years. Because what we're going to have is a return to the old-fashioned feudalism, but it'll be a high-tech. Remember, feudalism didn't have a middle class. It had the elite, you know, the dukes, the earls, the barons, the kings, and the knights, and all that stuff. And then there were peasants, you know, just plain peasants planting potatoes. Well, that's what they want to make us today, but in a high-tech era. So what's an example of that? If you look at, like, China, for example, one of my articles is called Looming Economic Disaster. You can see that online. And in there I put a picture. It's in Beijing, and it has this beautiful skyscraper where the high-tech, well-paid people are. But if you look down below, on the grass are these two peasant women cutting the grass with scissors. Not a lawnmower, just scissors. Clip, clip, clip. So what their plan is to beat us on the brains aspect at the top and beat us with a labor price and competition on the bottom. They actually, you remember when Henry Ford began, he had the assembly line and he had different division, brake division, so forth. China has actually done that with whole towns. Putian, mm-hmm. Putian would make like most of the tennis shoes in the world. Another one, Zhenju, I think it's called, they would make most of the jeans, the laptop computers in the world. So what you do with education, you start, you know, little Timmy or whatever, the Chinese one or something, would say two tennis shoes plus two tennis shoes equals four. Everything was done in terms of tennis shoes. So by the time that child got out of school, he knew everything there was and could way outcompete any American manufacturers in tennis shoes or, you know, laptops or making blue jeans or whatever it is. So they because it's a controlled society. I talked to the head of U.S.-China links a couple of years ago, and she had just made her, I think, 600th visit or something to China. And she said, you know what I've done? I've just visited a school over there. It has 10,000 students. They get to school at 6 in the morning for calisthenics, and they don't leave until 10 o'clock at night. They're going to beat us. In India, the same thing. There are 50 million students in high school in India and China. 50 million. They're taking 4 years of algebra, 4 years of geometry, 4 years of trigonometry, 4 years of calculus, and they're integrating statistics with it. They're taking 4 years of biology, 4 years of chemistry, and 4 years of physics. You try and find an American student who's even taking 1 year of physics and calculus. It's very hard. Mm-hmm. They're going to beat us to a pulp in the near future.
No, Dennis, you're absolutely right. I know that you're at the end of the time that you have with us, but would you please take a few seconds, really a few minutes, to talk about your mom.
Okay, I appreciate that. My mom has just become 95, and the hospital gave her the wrong medicine and really hurt her badly, and she wound up, she fell out of her bed and whacked her head and fractured ribs and so forth. But what it did was make her an almost comatose condition. She's not dead now, but she's lost the use of her legs. And what I'd appreciate is if your listeners would just look at GoFundMe, GoFundMe, and her name is Peggy Cuddy, C-U-D-D-Y, and you'll see a video, about just a 4 or 5 minute video, of how they discharged her. This isn't how she came. This is how they discharged her. She's just gone in there for urinary tract infection, and this is what the way she came out. And it's been horrible. It's been very, very costly over the past 4 years since that's happened. So I'd appreciate it if your listeners would just take a look at that. There's a little description of what happened, and I would thank them from the bottom of my heart for any help they can give her.
Okay. Well, I appreciate that. Dennis, and I also want to mention to our listeners, this would be a great opportunity if you've got a prayer circle or you have an opportunity, this lady needs your prayers as well. So, Dennis, thank you for being our guest, and let's plan a time that we can get you back on very, very soon, because, like I said, you just barely scratched the surface, and I don't know anyone who spent more time studying and researching all these different subjects. And you obviously know where the bodies are buried. So, Dennis, thank you for being our guest.
Yeah, we didn't even get into Oklahoma City and what really happened there.
Oh, we've got a ton of stuff to talk about. All I can say is I look forward to the next time you're a guest on Connecting the Dots. And with that, we need to move into our commercial break. And we'll pick it up on the other side with Paul Dreesen. Thank you, Dennis. I appreciate you being our guest.
Thanks for having me.
All righty. Thank you.
And we are, as a people, inherently and historically opposed to secret societies. to secret oaths, and to secret proceedings. For we are opposed around the world by a monolithic and ruthless conspiracy that relies primarily on covert means for expanding its sphere of influence.
It was 1776 when the founders signed the writ of independence from the Brits. It was revolution. Now an enemy from within would enslave us all again and deprive us of our rights in the Constitution. Restore the Republic. Wake up, it's time to understand. Restore the Republic. We're losing our freedom in the land.
Paul Dreesen is our guest for the second hour of Connecting the Dots with Dan Happel. And Paul's been a guest on our program several times before. Frankly, it is never often enough because, Paul, you are a gentleman who really, really understands the New World Order. You really understand the subject that we're talking about today, and that is controlling the population, controlling people, and controlling the agenda that is really in charge of what's happening in the world. And so with that, Paul is a fellow at the CFACT, which is a Committee for Constructive Tomorrow. He's a senior policy analyst there. He's also involved with the Congress of Racial Equality and the Heartland Institute. And Paul is a very accomplished author, and he is someone who I believe our listeners, I've had a lot of comments when you were on our program before, Paul, and I just want to thank you for being our guest again. And what Dr. Cuddy was talking about leads perfectly into the subject of eco-imperialism, which you wrote a great book on, and how the Illuminati, the New World Order, the powers that be, the power elite, whatever you want to call them, are doing things that are so counterproductive to what they're supposed to be doing to take care of all of society. Of course, they wrap everything in all these glowing warm terms, and meanwhile, they're doing the exact opposite. Paul, welcome to the show, first of all, and then thank you, and please tell our listeners a little bit more about yourself and some of the books that you've and some of the writings that you've done, not necessarily books, but some of the writings, and then let's get into eco-imperialism.
Well, Dan, that was a nice introduction, and I thank you for it very much. It's nice to be back with you. My background is energy, ecology, geology, environment and resource law, and years spent in the public policy arena dealing with climate change and energy and all sorts of related topics, minerals, forest fires, anything that's in the realm of modern environmentalism and human development, access to technologies, and battling the people that collectively have tens of billions of dollars available to them to contest us, people in middle America, people in the developing world, and so forth, but to bring into battle against us tens of billions of dollars on their side and a lot of government and a lot of media people to essentially control every aspect of our energy, our lives, our livelihoods, our basic rights, human populations, agriculture, transportation, communication, access to information. They want to control every aspect of our lives based on their crazy ideas about energy, fossil fuels, climate change, organic foods and so forth, biotechnology. And so I've been writing about this for quite a few years now. Eco-imperialism, Green Power, Black Death was my first book, but I've written other books, some of them with Ron Arnold, some of them on my own, and talking about the green machine, essentially, and the power and money it has, talking about climate change, biotechnology, and various other topics. And I've written many hundreds of articles at this point tackling those same topics. The battle goes on. It's for the hearts and souls and livelihoods and lives and freedoms of all of us. And the other problem, of course, that I have with these folks on the other side is they want all power and control, but no accountability for anything they do, whether it was deliberate or just a screw-up, no transparency for what they're doing, and all of it based on their utopian ideas that must never be exposed to the light of day in terms of their real impact or whether or not there's a scintilla of evidence to back up the claims they're making about climate change or biotechnology. So it's a huge battle for our lives, our livelihoods, our capitalist free enterprise system, and the freedoms that we have long enjoyed. I'm glad to be involved in the battle, and I'm glad you're with me, Dan.
Well, very definitely, Paul. And I have to go back to the Club of Rome and Limits of Growth, and that book outlined how the power elite, the Club of Rome, spent several meetings trying to decide just exactly how they were going to present a problem that would unite the world, unite the citizens of the world, in a way that they could control the dialogue, could control the press, could control the whole, let's say, the whole movement. And they looked at a number of options, and they landed squarely on environmentalism and the fact that man was destroying the planet and that man was destroying the environment. And that's
well, I wouldn't
right
say the
in
fact that, Dan. Don't use that word. The claim that man is destroying the planet.
right, exactly.
Careful in your words there.
Yeah. Well, yeah, it definitely was not a fact. That's the way they presented it. And, yes, that was kind of where the environmental movement, and if, you know, doing a kind of a follow-up on what Dr. Cuddy was talking about, Richard Nixon created the Environmental Protection Agency, which was the first step in that. And then we started creating things like the Federal Policy Land Management Act and endangered species, and all that started to happen in a big way after the Club of Rome came out with the decision on the environment, that would be the uniting force that they would use to take control, literally, of all the countries around the world under a globalist plan. So I know you're going to speak on that, and I just kind of wanted to pull that element in. So let's go from there, because you know where all the bodies are buried as well.
Well, I don't know where all of them are buried, but I know where some of them are. Yeah, you make an excellent point there. Club of Rome is a starting point for a lot of this. We have met the enemy, and they is us, as Pogo said. We humans are the enemy for the planet, for wildlife, and so forth, and those on the left have the solutions. So their first real boogeyman was resource depletion. We are exhausting the world's supplies of oil and gas and metals and so forth, and you've seen over the years how false that is. Fracking unleashed all kinds of new energy supplies. Our human ingenuity, above all, is what's responsible for where we are now and where we go in the future. And if human ingenuity is shackled, we're not going to go very far. And that's part of the goal of all of this, too. So their second approach, besides, was just overall pollution. We are poisoning the planet with all these modern technologies that helped to lift people out of the abject poverty and disease and malnutrition that haunted people worldwide, blocked our access to longer lives for thousands of years, and then all of a sudden, as we started using fossil fuels in the 1800s, we started raising living standards and lifespans, and that's where we are today. But they don't want that. They want to control populations. We've got too many. They don't want to kill off themselves or their kids. They want to are happy with killing off lots of other people, especially dark-skinned people in developing countries. Too many people on the planet. So their third topic was, of course, climate change, the claim that we are now, with our fossil fuel emissions, threatening the very survival of civilization and planet. And they hoist up all sorts of arguments and claims that have no basis in real-world evidence. The real world outside our windows does not comport with the computer models and headlines that we're hearing all the time. So what they're trying to do is make the real world, reform it to make it, at least the perception of the real world, make it fit their description of it. The other thing that we have to keep in mind is that even organizations that began with really good purposes, and EPA was basically an effort to pull together various federal agencies that already existed and put them under one roof to address the serious pollution problems we had back in the 60s and early 70s. And we fixed them, and we have cleaner air and water than maybe ever before in this country, longer lives than ever before. But now EPA and a lot of other federal agencies have been taken over by this mindset that we can have zero pollution, that we can't have any use of fossil fuels and so forth. And it's not just EPA. It's a lot of other federal agencies, but it's also the World Bank, which began as an effort to make loans to developing countries and improve their living standards, the Food and Agricultural Organization, the UN, the USAID, Agency for International Development. They've all been taken over by this anti-development, anti-people, climate change, anti-modern farming methods mentality. And that's where we are today, with tremendously negative effects on us here in the United States, but especially people who are still the most impoverished, malnourished, power-deprived people on the planet. And we need to address that. So I'm here today to hopefully get to the bottom of some of this and chat with you about it.
Well, thank you, Paul, and that's a great lead-in. One of the things that you mentioned is your eco-imperialism, the green power, black death, because that is a really important book, because it shows how the same people who are talking about us destroying the environment and how, you know, they're being so thoughtful about third world countries. It's of course, the boogeyman is always the developed countries, not the underdeveloped countries, but the developed countries. And yet they're using their environmental programs to stifle development in the undeveloped countries, because let's face it, they want us all back in the Stone Age. That's really where they want us, with a handful of them controlling the whole process. They've got the technology. We have, as you mentioned, and certainly Dr. Cuddy mentioned, technocracy, where they have so many capabilities to control everything that we do, everything we see, everything we buy, everything we produce. They have the ability to control all those things. And isn't that exactly what they plan to do?
Oh, it absolutely is. They want to control us and send us back to an earlier living standard, but not them. There is a big dichotomy there. They really, I think, believe they were put on the planet because they have more wisdom and more skill sets and the reason they're here is to control everybody else's lives and make the world a utopia. That was kind of the old idea of Soviet and fascist and other ideologies of the 20th century. You have to break a few eggs to make an omelet, and I have not seen any omelets so far, but I've seen tens and hundreds of millions of people slaughtered, starved to death, imprisoned in gulags, and dying very slow, unnatural deaths in the name of some of these ideologies, and environmentalism has basically taken over from fascism and communism. Red on the inside, green on the outside, like a watermelon. Let me give you just one quick example here. If you're looking outside of South Africa, the sub-Saharan nations, on an annual basis, the average family, the average individual, has 1.4% of the average American's electricity. That means that in an average year, those people in sub-Saharan Africa have electricity about 123 hours per year, or 2.5 hours a week, 20 minutes a day, and they never know when they're going to have it or if they're going to have it. And yet they are being told by the World Bank, USAID, the Sierra Club, Greenpeace, Democrat politicians, a lot of other folks, that they should improve their lives, yes, but only a little bit, only at the margins, and only to the extent that it's possible by using wind and solar and biotechnology. And other than that, they're going to be stuck where they are. Their agriculture should improve, but only to the extent they can use organic methods, not even tractors, not insecticides to control insects, not modern fertilizers to improve the output, not modern seeds, but go back literally decades in hundreds of years, or stay where they are with traditional organic agriculture. And you know what that means. It means the subsistence agriculture that they've used for millennia and keeps them on the margins, keeps them malnourished. Their kids die young, and they're stuck in that. And this is all put in the terms of protecting the environment, protecting the planet from the ravages of capitalism and modern agriculture, modern energy, modern living standards. I mean, it's a sick, perverse morality that is being foisted on all of us, but especially on the poorest and most energy-deprived people on the planet. I find it absolutely reprehensible, and it leads to huge amounts of eco-manslaughter. No better word for it, I don't think.
Yeah, I think that's a perfect term. And we see in Venezuela a perfect example of a very, very wealthy country with tremendous natural resources, and just exactly how communism and socialism can destroy the most productive economies and the most viable economies. And now the people literally starving to death, going through trash heaps and trash dumps just to get enough food to try to survive. And there's no excuse for that. But yet they continue to push this globalist agenda, which is a melding of communism, socialism, and capitalism into a common world government. And quite frankly, they're destroying the good parts of our system, which is free markets, and bringing in these socialist programs that destroy our ability to advance as a civilization.
Yeah, absolutely. And I'm glad you brought up Venezuela. One of my neighbors grew up in Venezuela and managed to get out, and her parents in the last few years managed to get out just ahead of the things really falling apart. And they have to add a little bit of levity to this. I don't know if anybody in our listening audience has heard of Ava Martinez, but she's an 8-year-old girl who impersonates Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez and her Green New Deal ideas and so forth, and she was talking about some of this the other day. She said that she was talking about social media, and she said, well, do you realize that social media, the short term for social media is socialism, and socialism is a great program, and the most successful socialist countries in the world are Venezuela and Facebook and Twitter. Anyway, she just goes on with these little rants. It's absolutely hysterical, but by the same token, she's reflecting the kind of mindset and wisdom and concept of reality that Ocasio-Cortez and her like-minded colleagues and followers are actually trying to foist on us in the real world. So the hilarity of this little Martinez girl's political commentaries is offset starkly against the reality that we're really having to deal with in so many parts of the world, and it's being advocated and advanced by the lefty people in this country who think they're onto something, think they're so smart, so much smarter than the rest of us, and they should be in charge, and everything's going to be hunky-dory, just like it is in Venezuela or Russia or some of these other fine places that we could have grown up in if we weren't so lucky to be born here in America, or at least have a chance to grow up here in America and live here.
Yeah, exactly. Paul, I hear the break coming up. We're going to break for our commercial break, but we'll pick it up on the other side of the break. Okay, we're back from the break. And
That was a quick break. You've got sponsors that give you so much money for 2 seconds worth of break time.
Exactly. Well, I'll let Brenda edit all these things out, but I had to have that pause so that we could insert whatever we need. Again, our guest for this second hour is Paul Dreesen. Paul is a fellow with the Center for CFACT. I know the
Committee for a Constructive Tomorrow.
There we go.
CFACT, yes.
Yeah,
because we believe in improving not just the planet, but the people on the planet. And we all live here together.
Yeah, absolutely. And I have to tell you, you know, you were talking about the young girl that impersonates Alexandria Cortez, and I have to say that one of the things that pops out to me is how they refuse to talk about all the losses, all the things that are happening that are in a very negative way. And I've got a good friend by the name of Harry Bouyans. He's been a guest on our radio show a number of times. And Harry is a PhD physicist from South Africa who fled because of the takeover by the communists. And that really happened under Mandela. It happened with Mandela. But now the country of South Africa has gone from, at one time they were, I believe, number 13 in the world in the biggest economies in the world, and now they're very rapidly becoming a real true third world country because they've been destroying the white middle class in that country. They're certainly destroying the agriculture in that country, which was at one time, like Rhodesia, the breadbasket of the world. So obviously communism is a very, very failed experiment. And I'm going to ask you, Paul, why do you think they keep wanting to try to reinvent the wheel? It's pretty obvious that the system fails, but it doesn't fail if people can figure out a way to control it. Am I right with that?
Well, you know, if we go back a little bit, Rhodesia and South Africa were both pretty nasty systems with the whites on the top of the heap in a pretty much apartheid system. And thankfully, South Africa at least got a pretty good transition from that into Nelson Mandela's government, which was well run for the most part and really tried to put the past behind him and charge forward into the modern era. But Mandela's successors didn't have his commitment to honesty and transparency and just giving everybody the equal opportunities to move forward. The governments there have become so corrupt, they can't even get a modern power plant built anymore anywhere near the schedule, and yet they're still so energy, electricity starved, even in South Africa. They could be a shining light, and they're far from doing that right now. I think we have to recognize where Africa has been and the colonial powers that in many ways improved things but also held people back and were somewhat racist in their approaches and their policies and the way people lived. But now, as with so many other parts of the world, there are these tremendous opportunities. We've seen governments that work. We've seen technologies that work, fossil fuels and other energy technologies that have lifted billions of people up out of poverty and disease and malnutrition to the kind of living standards and lifespans we enjoy here and in Europe and Australia, Canada. And yet you've got a whole cadre of people who only see the negatives, and most of the negatives they see there are products of their fertile imaginations, because the negatives don't really exist in the real world, or they can be addressed by proper forms of government and personal responsibility and ethics. But it's all being corrupted. It's all being done with lies and secrecy, no accountability for the people that screw up or go out and deliberately try to harm people's lives and livelihoods. There's a tremendous amount of oppression and suppression of ideas by people like you and me and conservative thinkers, and whether it's on college campuses or it's social media, there's a massive effort underway to shut down people like us who have, like Prager University or What's Up With That, for a climate website. Anybody that has an opinion different from the hard left viewpoints needs to be silenced and prosecuted and jailed for having those different points of view. You even hear members of Congress like Sheldon, or I call him Torquemada Whitehouse, demanding prosecution and jail time under RICO standards and laws for people that doubt climate change, is the way they put it, or deny climate change. And of course, we don't deny climate change. What we doubt and deny is this notion that man-made climate change has suddenly become an unprecedented problem, that somehow our fossil fuels and our carbon dioxide emissions, what we exhale and what makes plants grow, has suddenly become a dangerous pollutant that must be rooted out by eliminating fossil fuels. And anybody that challenges that kind of thinking should be prosecuted and jailed. That's where we're going with so much of this. Mm-hmm. And it's bad enough that our living standards might be rolled back a decade or two or three. But for them to then apply those same attitudes and policies and perverse moralities on the poorest people on the planet, and again tell them, you're allowed to improve your lives, but only a tiny bit, and only without fossil fuels, and otherwise you're going to be kept right where you are in your place. The mm-hmm. Africans are no longer going to tolerate that, nor will the Asians, and nor should we.
Right. Well, one of the things that comes out of all these discussions is the fact that the Illuminati, the power elite, the people who want to create all these programs, are the biggest racists and sexists and everything else in the world. I mean, these are the people that are trying to destroy large segments of human population by controlling everything they do and everything they eat and everything about them. And I guarantee you that they, in their own writings, and their own, Margaret Sanger was a perfect example. Dr. Cuddy brought that out early. She was a tremendous racist, and she was a eugenicist. And this is the kind of people that have been creating the scenario, and yet they're trying to paint us, the conservatives, who are trying to return to a constitutional government and a land where individualism and responsibility, personal responsibility, are something that we have as a society, and they're trying to destroy that. Do you see that as being one of the reasons behind a lot of these programs, is the fact that they really are racist, and they're trying to figure out a way to destroy everyone that stands against them, and then they're going to get rid of anybody they don't like?
Yeah, there's a lot of that happening. I mean, you look at the environmentalist movement. It has become a movement of rich, privileged, urban, campus-oriented white people. You don't see all that many black people or Hispanics in the movement, or Asians. And when you look at the policies that they are pushing, they have their most imperialistic, carbon colonialistic, eco-manslaughtering impacts on the poorest people on the planet. If you want to go past Margaret Sanger and her own racism, take one more step and you look at the Nazis, Hitler and Goering and the rest of that lot. They were some of the first proponents of environmentalism and vegetarianism, controlling the environment, protecting the environment. Goering once sent a guy to a concentration camp because he'd used a live frog as bait, and Goering was appalled by that kind of practice, and yet he was fine with sending millions of people to those concentration camps and wiping them out. Hitler was a vegetarian, Goering was. A lot of those guys were, in their own sick minds, saviors of the planet and getting rid of the undesirable elements on the planet. For them, it was the Slavs, the Jews, the Gypsies, the mentally impaired, physically impaired people that they wanted to get rid of. And for the environmentalists, they don't have any problem at all with the millions of deaths they cause every year by denying people access to fossil fuel energy, nuclear energy, hydroelectric energy, insecticides to control diseases and improve crop production, denying them access to biotechnology crops or to modern fertilizers. The net result is millions of dead people, especially children, and they don't have a problem with that. They certainly don't want to talk about it. They certainly hide it. But bottom line is they believe in Paul Ehrlich and that whole lot, who claimed we were facing massive famines and overpopulation because we couldn't grow enough food, and these people, the poor black people on the planet, poor Hispanics and Asians, there were too many of them anyway, as Environmental Defense Fund's chief scientist Charles Worster said at one point, we have too many people on the planet, and banning DDT is as good a way to get rid of some of them as anything. That's what we're talking about. That's what we're dealing with. And for them to have been able to turn this whole concept of ethics and morality and free enterprise capitalism and the creative innovations that have brought us cell phones and modern biotechnology and modern crops and erosion control, water technology like the Israeli desalination system, somehow those things are all bad, and what they're espousing that ends up killing people is somehow saving the planet and therefore good. It's just sick. I don't know.
It is sick.
How
and,
you
and
turn
it's,
it around, but we got to be battling this and confronting them with their poisonous views and their sexist and racist policies, their perverse moralities. We have to take mm-hmm. them head on. Don't let them get away with this stuff anymore.
We do, and we have to recognize that communism and national socialism is where most of the environmental movement started. I mean, the Nazis, you mentioned Goering and Hitler, the fact that the first really organized environmental movement by a national government was the National Socialists, the Nazis. And they were really in touch with this environmentalism, and they used their controlled society system as a way to promote their environmentalism. And, you know, we hear from groups like ISIS and, you know, we radical Islam and groups like that that say one thing truthfully, and that is that the systems behind the American Green Movement are really anti-humanist. And I've heard that comment by a number of people. This is a perfect example of it.
Yeah, it absolutely is. And we go back again to the most brilliant environmentalist strategy ever developed, which is climate change, this notion that human beings somehow have suddenly acquired the ability to control the climate, and if we just get rid of fossil fuels, we can set the Earth's temperature at whatever they determine is the ideal or proper temperature. We can end storms and famines and droughts and other problems just by controlling how much carbon dioxide goes into the atmosphere. I mean, they always talk about greenhouse gases, but carbon dioxide is the really big one. And yet CO2 is 0.04% of the Earth's atmosphere, a trivial amount. This idea that all of a sudden it has become the thermostat for planetary temperatures and weather events is just insane. And when you look at the predictions that they foist on us from their computer models, those are completely out of whack with reality outside the window. For example, the models are predicting right now that we should be having average planetary temperatures a full degree Fahrenheit above what we're actually measuring. So their models are off by an entire degree already, and the margin between prediction and reality is increasing every single year. Tornadoes. We had a lot more tornadoes, violent F3 to F5 tornadoes from 1950 to 1985 than we've had in the 30-plus years since then. Last year, we didn't have a single F3 to F5 tornado touchdown here in the United States. Hurricanes, we had a 12-year drought with not a single Category 3 to 5 hurricane hitting the United States. That had never happened before. The previous record was 9 years set back in the 1860s. So everything they're predicting is not happening out there in the real world, and yet the headlines keep pounding on the same claims over and over, and they're being used to justify the Green New Deal, which would eliminate our fossil fuels, our driving, our air flights, our modern homes, give government control over what temperature you can have your home set at, how many miles you can go in a particular year, and what kind of agriculture we can have, what kinds of industries we can have. And meanwhile, keep this in mind too, the rest of the world, particularly China and India and all the developing countries, are under no obligation to reduce their fossil fuel use or carbon dioxide emissions. and they're not going to. They realize fossil fuels are the only way forward. It's 80% of U.S. and world energy right now is fossil fuels. We get rid of ours, we're going to just send our living standards back by decades. One of the reasons the Australian Conservatives won this last weekend is because they kept pointing out that Australia's total carbon dioxide emissions are less than the annual increase in carbon dioxide emissions just from China. And yet Australia was being told it needed to eliminate its carbon dioxide emissions and fossil fuels and industries, while China and India and the rest of the Pacific Rim nations just increased theirs on an annual basis forever and ever until they decide they don't need to do it anymore. So this whole system that we're facing is anti-people, anti-industry, anti-modern living standards, with no concern at all for the lives and livelihoods that will be lost in the process.
You know, that's exactly right. And it is almost verbatim the outline of UN Agenda 21. If you look at the Green New Deal, it's almost line for line identical to what the Agenda 21 policies are outlining for the industrialized countries. And I have to say, it's fascinating to me that they attack all the industrial countries, and they also attack those that are the free countries, the countries that have capitalism and the, you know, more individual liberties, and yet they give a free pass for all the socialist and the communist countries. And that tells me that it's not about the environment, it's about politics.
Oh, absolutely. And it's a really sick form of politics as well. Politics should be designed to improve people's lives and work out compromises and improve living standards for people around the world. And it's been co-opted, corrupted, demoralized, I guess you can say, in terms of moral standards. Not just in this country, but in so many other places, all driving the same insane green agenda that is so anti-human and really anti-environment, because when you look at the impacts from wind and solar and biofuels and batteries and all the approved energy technologies, their environmental and human impacts are far worse by orders of magnitude than anything you can lay at the feet of fossil fuels or nuclear power. The land involved, the environmental impacts, the human rights abuses that are engaged in routinely by China, for example, with developing its rare earth and cadmium deposits that it owns or controls around the world. Child labor is rampant in those places. There are no labor or safety or environmental or health standards associated with any of their operations. And yet, again, they get a free pass on all that, whereas a modern American or Canadian company gets raked over the coals for any environmental impacts they cause. So the whole operation that we're dealing with is incredibly perverse, immoral, unethical, and yet rarely do you hear anybody challenging them on that.
No, that's right. We're seeing a total flip-flop on who the polluters are. Of course, we've always recognized, Paul, you've mentioned this in your writings, is that the industrialized countries, the wealthier nations, are the ones who have the ability, because they are wealthier, to create the environmental limitations and controls that improve pollution, that improve the resource depletion, that improve the things that they're attacking as being a proof of capitalism as a failure. And yet those communist countries, I know right now communist China is far and away the largest polluter in the world. And I read recently that their carbon footprint is double what the United States is, and yet we're expected to go to zero.
Yeah, and let me bring out another point on this. They always like to talk about the carbon footprint. They're not talking about carbon. Carbon is deliberately chosen because it conjures up the idea of carbon, soot, dirt, pollution coming out of black pollution coming out of smokestacks and stuff. What they're talking about is burning carbon-based fuels and generating not just energy but carbon dioxide in the process. So they're not talking about a carbon footprint, they're talking about a carbon dioxide footprint. And yet the more carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, the better and faster plants grow. And there is nothing in the real world that ties carbon dioxide into some system that can control the Earth's climate. So we got to go back to what I was saying just a little bit ago about the realities of climate change, where we're not seeing anything catastrophic or unprecedented, or in our extreme weather events, any of those sorts of things, but we're being told that based on garbage in, garbage out computer models and a bunch of headlines and assertions and lies and distortions, exaggerations and fabrications, that we're facing this terrible climate crisis. Therefore, we need to get rid of all those fossil fuels that make our modern lives and living standards possible. Again, this whole thing is just such a circular lie and such a distorted vision of reality, but also based on really distorted, perverse morality that results in so many human impacts and environmental impacts that we're not supposed to talk about either.
Right, right. Well, I know that Bill Nye, the science guy, went on a rant last week about how man was destroying the world and we were literally, the planet was on fire, and that we were, there was no question about it. There was no denying the fact that our climate is under attack by humans. And in fact, we've had one of the coldest winters in many, many decades. We've right now, the tornadoes that we're seeing in Oklahoma and in the Midwest are a result of a major cold front that came through Arizona. I'm in southern Arizona, and we had almost freezing temperatures last night. The high yesterday was 69 degrees, and it's the cold temperatures hitting the warm air that was coming up from the Gulf that causes those tornadoes. It has nothing to do with CO2, but yet they tried, the geniuses on the mainstream media try to make a connection with man-caused global warming. Isn't that a fascinating thing?
Yeah, it is, and you're absolutely right about what causes those tornadoes. The United States has more tornadoes by far than all the rest of the world combined, and it's because of the Rocky Mountains and the way they channel that cold Arctic air down through where it collides with the warm, moist Gulf of Mexico air. And yet, when you look at, again, the reality, you go back to 1954 to 1985, we were getting 56 F3 to F5 tornadoes per year on average. Since then, we've only been getting 34 F3 to F5 tornadoes on average. So a drop, huge drop, 50% drop in the number of violent tornadoes hitting the United States every year in the last 30 years versus the previous 30 years. And as I said earlier, last year we didn't have one single F3 to F5 violent tornado in the United States. So it's pretty sick when the news media colludes with these deep state scientists, so-called Bill Nye, the fake science guy, and his F-word-laced profanity-strewn monologue last week, or the politicians that are banking their political futures on all of this crazy stuff. You watch what's really going on out in the world, and it's completely different from what we're seeing in the media, in the political circles. And yet, people are being hit with these lies on a steady basis, and a lot of people are believing them because they're repeated so often.
Yeah,
and
absolutely.
The bottom line is the policies being advocated to save us from this non-existent problem would be devastating for the United States and the whole world.
It will. It will. Paul, I hate to say this, but we're running out of time. I know that it's been a while since we've had you on, and we need to get you back more often. I hope you'll return and we can continue this dialogue, because there's so much to cover here, and you do such a wonderful job of covering it. Again, I want to thank you for that. Do you have any sites or anything you want to leave our listeners with so that they can find out more about you and the groups that you work with?
I certainly do, and I'd recommend three places to go to read my things. One is cfact.org, cfact.org. Second one is townhall.com, and the third one is What's Up With That, W-A-T-T-S. upwiththat.com, which is an incredible website devoted to energy and climate issues and heavily read by a lot of scientists. So you get some very good feedback on that one that's very well informed. But thanks for giving me this opportunity. I always love being with you and look forward to doing it many more times over the next couple of years.
Well, we'll continue with this, because I know that I had Ron Arnold on with someone else here, it's been a while back, and that was just as your book was coming out with Ron Arnold, and I want to see if I can get both of you gentlemen back on together, because I think the expose of where the money flows through the green movement, I mean, it's pretty obvious that the whole plan is about money and control. So again, Paul, thank you for being our guest today. And with that, I ask our listeners, please join us again next week and let us help you to connect some more dots. Thank you, and we'll see you next week.